Because of our friendship, I wrote a short scene for David in Yellowbeard, and he came down to join the party in Mexico. I even jumped into his jockstrap once when he casually cancelled his appearance as the Pied Piper in Shelley Duvall's fairy tale theatre, and she called me in tears to fill in for him. You've not seen disappointment till you've tried on a jockstrap for a dresser who has designed it specially for David Bowie. So it was me who had 200 rats calling over him in Toronto, and not him. Not just any old rats either, but Hollywood rats, trained in L.A. and flown to Canada on a one-way ticket, a journey which for them ended up as snake fodder in the Toronto Zoo. A perfect metaphor for showbiz. One minute you're in a movie, the next you're being fed to the pythons. Tanya and I spent many good times with David. He and Mick both came to our wedding reception. They sweetly brought out the cake for a very nervous Tanya to cut. There was a huge bouquet of flowers from Mike Nichols, and on his card to Tanya, he gave her excellent advice for her wedding night. Act surprised. Tanya and I went to Welland Garden City in 1983 to see David on his serious Moonlight tour, and to Cannes for the opening of Merry Christmas, Mr. Lawrence, where the French medical students were on strike and had put plaster of Paris and bloodied bandages on every statue in town. We even went on two cruises with him, the first to the Windward Isles, where we were marooned on Mustique with Iggy Pop, as the rented yacht hadn't made it across the Atlantic, and they stuck us for a week in Princess Margaret's rather pretty Oliver Messel villa. Before dinner, I made the mistake of asking for a rum punch, and Mrs. Lane, Princess Margaret's steely-eyed cook, said severely, "We don't meddle with a rum." Oops, bet she didn't say that to PM, as everybody on the island called the Queen's sister. She would put religious tracts under our pillow with red warnings about the devil. I kept a sharp eye out, but I never saw him, at least under the pillow. One day, there was a terrific shrieking from a terrified cook. A bird had gotten into Mrs. Lane's kitchen, and she was freaking out. I went in and calmly opened a window, and it flew out. She never bullied me again. I think she thought I had saved her from the devil. Finally, the boat arrived, and we left the island on a wonderful yacht. One night we hoaxed the crew by telling them it was going to be drag night. With Bowie and Idol on board, they decided they'd better make a real effort. And so at cocktail time, a fully glammed-up staff emerged on deck, dressed to the nines, with the captain leading the way in a blonde wig, twinset and pearls. When we emerged, dressed normally, they realized they'd been had. Being British, they were still game to go ashore with us for dinner in their frocks and wigs. Another time we cruised the Italian coast with the beautiful Iman, and David took us to Campo di Thermi, where he had done his first gig. He spoke movingly about his dad and how proud he had been of him. David was also a proud parent, bringing up Joe, of whom I am a strangely useless godfather, and I was always happy that he had a daughter with Iman. I could never get him to be friends with George Harrison, though. I would say to George, "He's wonderful and brilliant and funny," but then George would become very much a Beatle. "Oh, Bowie," he would say, contemptuously, to rhyme with Bow Wow. I even got David as far as Henley once, but George would not admit him. Stubborn buggers, Beatles. In 1987, Tanya and I were on holiday in the south of France with Robin Williams and family, and David invited us to come for lunch to see his new yacht. Steve Martin and Michael Caine were filming nearby Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, and we all turned up at the quayside to find a simply enormous boat, with David wavering from the top deck. We all stared at this huge vessel in stunned amazement. "Fuck me, Eric," said Michael Caine. "We're in the wrong fucking business." David was always extremely generous, and in early 1991 he lent me his wonderful house on Mustique to write a movie. Tanya and I spent an idyllic 6 weeks in this lovely Balinese home of many waters that he had built high on a hillside overlooking a beautiful bay, with our tiny new daughter Lily floating around in the pool. I'd had the idea for the film when a friend told me he'd been found as a baby in a telephone booth in Sloane Square. This seemed so very Oscar Wilde. A handbag! And it reminded me of some friends of ours who had had too good a time at a party and left, forgetting their baby was asleep in a bedroom with the coats. Of course, when they got home, they remembered and panicked and raced back. But what if the baby had been gone? I like the idea of a wealthy, hippie, 60s upper-class couple forgetting their heir in a restaurant. Searching desperately, they were given the wrong baby, Rick Moranis, who grew up to become the Duke of Bournemouth, while the rightful heir, me, grew up with an Indian family in Southgate. Universal liked my script, and I came back to England with 8 million quid to spend. But it was January, and it was 3 weeks before I could find anybody to work. That Easter, John Cleese invited us to join his expedition to Egypt. It was tough, I can tell you, on a luxury boat with a jacuzzi on the top deck floating gently up the Nile, with no one for company but John Cleese, Peter Cook, William Goldman, Stephen Fry, and 40 other assorted friends. John and Alice Faye very generously paid for the entire trip, and even arranged for the British Museum to give us a private tour before we left London, and for the Cairo Museum to open early so we could gaze undisturbed at the sarcophagus of Tutankhamun. He didn't look a bit like Steve Martin. The boat itself had air-conditioned bedrooms, each with a private bathroom and a little balcony where I could sit and play guitar. Tanya won the Easter parade with a hat composed of the many medicaments she had taken with her to avoid almost every known form of tropical disease. People were very grateful for that hat. Peter Cook was in great form and would usually skip the day tours of the temples and pyramids so he could be hilarious in the evenings. He was, but the temples and burial sites were unbelievable. Some of them so recently excavated they looked as if the painters had just left. I crossed the Nile at dawn on a tiny boat to fly in a hot air balloon as the sun rose over the Valley of Kings. Each day at tea time, Stephen Fry would read us a chapter of Billy Bunter on the Nile, a popular 50s kids' book, as we glided past villagers in colourful robes winnowing, straight out of illustrated scenes from a children's Bible. Oh, it was rough, let me tell you. But I had to get serious and return to London to begin work on Heirs and Graces, whose title, Universal, had changed to Splitting Heirs. We shot the movie in the glorious summer of 1992 at Longleat, the magnificent palatial home of the Marquess of Bath. Barbara Hershey played the 60s hippie, and John Cleese a shady lawyer, giving one of the most emotionally charged performances of his career. Catherine Zeta-Jones, in her first movie, played the love interest. Catherine was adorable, and Rick made special canvas backs for our chairs. Eric Zeta Idle, Rick Zeta Moranis, Barbara Zeta Hershey. The film went very well, and I got to do a nude scene with Catherine, though, sadly, it was I who was nude. Halfway through the shooting, Tanya and I flew to Florence for the marriage of David Bowie and Iman. David had asked me to make a speech at his wedding, and Tanya kept asking him for me just how low I should be. "Tell him to make it as low as he wants," David would reply. I, of course, went too far as usual, and I blush to think of it now. But it went down very well with the guests, who included Ono, Eno, and Bono. The studio was very happy with Splitting Heirs, and it was chosen by the French to be the British representative at the Cannes Film Festival. Chosen by the French, I emphasise, because some of the British press got their knickers in a twist. What was this comedy doing representing Britain? Well, getting laughs, for one, since it played very well at the screening. But at the press conference, I was publicly attacked by Baz Bamigboy and Alexander Walker. The rest of the world's press looked on amazed that the British tried to eat their own. How dare I? Who did I think I was? I have no idea what Baz was up to, but I reckon Alexander Walker was still seething because we had pilloried him in Monty Python as a pretentious fart with silly hair, even building a special wig, which grew slowly taller as Graham spoke. I was very happy when later Ken Russell took a stick to Walker on film night. Back home, the tabloids were hounding Catherine Zeta-Jones over a boyfriend issue, and at the last minute she pulled out of attending the festival. I don't blame her, but it meant I had to take the long walk up the famous Palais staircase all on my own. I think it was the loneliest I've ever felt. I decided there and then, right, that's it, fuck it, I'm leaving. If that's how you behave when someone brings 8 million back to spend in the country, I shall take my flops to America, where they don't even mind if you're successful. The unexpected press response to my movie in the UK caused Universal to have cold feet about the American release, and they pull back on the spending. I think a lot of the attacks on me were because they discovered I was 50, and therefore, by their reckoning, too old for the lead. I had outed myself by writing a cheeky letter to the Prime Minister. The Right Honourable John Major MP, 10 Downing Street, London, SW1A1AA, 12th of January, 1993. Dear Mr. Major, on the 29th of March, you and I will both be 50. Has it ever occurred to you that, but for a twist of fate, I should be Prime Minister and you could have been the man in the Nudge Nudge sketch from Monty Python? I do hope you don't feel too disappointed. Happy birthday anyway, Eric Idle. He wrote me an amusing reply about how his cricketing fans always said the first 50 was the hardest and invited me to 10 Downing Street, but sadly, the newspapers found out and had a go at me for being too old. It was enough for me. Tanya and I decided to bring up our daughter Lily in California. I felt I couldn't survive another 15 winters in St. John's Wood, and the idea of driving her to school in California seemed far more appealing. It was. Chapter 21, Runaway. As a young teenager riding on top of the 148, a double-decker Midland Red bus from Studley to Birmingham, I would pass through a suburb improbably called Hollywood. How could I possibly imagine 50 years later I would end up living in Hollywood, California, in a rambling old 1920s Spanish house? We moved to L.A. in 1994. Tanya and I had been discussing it for some time. She'd spent 17 years in England, only fair if we spent the next 17 years in the States. We had frequently wintered there, staying in a huge old pink house above Sunset with Garth and Uwe, lovely friends who rented out 3 or 4 suites to itinerant actors like Albert Finney and Greta Scacchi. The house and the pool were filled with beautiful models like Janice Dickinson and Lauren Hutton. There was music, ping-pong, dancing, art, food, and excellent conversation. We'd stayed there with the infant Lily, but now we would need to find somewhere to live. We would escape the Schadenfreudian nightmare of the UK and do a runner. It was almost as if I regretted not running away from boarding school all those years ago. Tawisi, we, our adorable Thai nanny, who made the most exquisite food, would come with us. It wasn't exactly Ellis Island, but I still had to wait downtown with immigration lawyers for green cards and driver's licenses. The only difference? Celebrity. You get spoiled rotten. Finally a good use for fame. Since I have a pathological fear of filling out forms, waiting in lines, and all officialdom, it was a great relief to be discreetly marched round the back and asked for autographs. It wasn't until I moved to America that I truly discovered I was funny. Suddenly I was making Steve Martin and Robin Williams laugh. Chevy Chase told people he wished he were really funny like me. Gary Shandling said he adored the Ruttles. It's appreciation by your peers that counts, and being in a group can make you feel insecure. My own TV show after Python, Rutland Weekend Television, had no live audience, and so I never knew if it was funny or not. Several people went out of their way to assure me it wasn't. My play, Pass the Butler, was hammered by some of the West End critics, though it ran for 6 months to gales of laughter. My solo film, Splitting Hairs, now also suffered critical abuse. In England, my future was behind me. It was time to leave. I went to California initially to make a speech for John Cleese at the Beverly Wilshire Hotel, where he was presented with the Screen Actors Guild's second annual Jack Oakey Award. The first was to Walter Matthau. There wasn't a third. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Actually, I'm here rather in error. The transatlantic phone line was very bad. It was Christmas. My mother was visiting, so I was shit-faced. And I could vaguely hear someone inviting me to a Jackie Oakey evening. And what I heard was a karaoke evening, so naturally I was very excited. Imagine my disappointment when I find it is instead some kind of salute to John Cleese, a man who has consistently ruined my life by being funnier, better known, and better paid than me. A man who hurt me deeply by giving the role I would have been perfect for in A Fish Called Wanda to Jamie Lee Curtis. A man alongside whom I've spent several days being crucified. Perhaps the worst job you can get in show business, with the exception of working for Jeffrey Katzenberg. Well, I've known John now for 31 years, which is perhaps the longest of anyone here. So while it is an excellent opportunity to make some cheap cracks about him and reveal some tasteless and extraordinary bits of gossip about him that I've picked up over the years, I think I can embarrass him far more successfully by being sincere. John is, quite simply, and it pains me to say this, the best. Perhaps even more irritatingly, he has turned himself into not just a nice person, but a morally fine, caring, thinking, teaching, incredibly generous, wise, and loving human being. And now, he's dead. Oh, I'm sorry, that's something I was writing for later. John responded with a very funny speech, complaining about how nobody ever mentioned his fucking humility. A line Mike Nichols found so hilarious, he told John he was going to steal it. Shortly after this tribute, Tanya, Lily and I were in Encino when the Northridge earthquake hit, on January the 17th at 4:30 in the morning. We were just 4.5 miles from its epicenter in Reseda in the San Fernando Valley. It had a 6.7 magnitude and lasted for an interminable 20 seconds. I was awoken by Nikolai the dog just after 4 in the morning and took him outside, but he just stood there looking confused, so I went back in with him. No sooner had I climbed into bed than the earthquake struck. It was like the sound of an express train coming through the bedroom. I held on to Tanya while the bed bounced until the whole house finished shaking and we could run and check on Lily. It seemed like an eternity, and we found her underneath a clown picture, which had fallen off the wall, but fortunately missed her. Downstairs the house was a mess, but we and I turned off the gas, swept up the broken glass, and we all went back to bed. The house continued rocking and swaying with aftershocks all night long. Even the dog jumped into our bed after a particularly big tremor. We were on Balboa Avenue, which at one point that night was both flooded and on fire. The wail of car alarms echoed round the valley. It was eerie. The house belonged to our friend Dave Stewart, of the Eurythmics, and fortunately for us, he was seriously paranoid about earthquakes and had built it to 3x code, so while it bounced a lot, it withstood the initial earthquake and the 3 weeks of aftershocks. The power was back on by noon the next day, and we sat in the jacuzzi and discussed what to do. Nobody was very keen on returning to an English January. The general consensus was that since this was the big one, we might as well stay. Eventually, I took some geological maps and discovered where granite and limestone intersected and bought a house there. I would start again. Chapter 22. Good at Dinner. It was a strange thing to emigrate at 50, but America truly is the land of opportunity. It took me a while to learn you don't need to take all of the opportunities. At first I was confused about what I should do, and a friend told me I was depressed and recommended therapy. That was a smart suggestion, and I've benefited from it ever since. There's nothing finer than paying someone to listen to you moan every week, and it helped me enormously. It still does to this day. I know the Brits think therapy is some kind of moral weakness, but we don't come with a manual, and it's good to find out what makes you tick. This time, I wanted to stay home for Lily and not be an absentee father, which I was a lot of the time for Carey. By this age, I was less obsessed with career and self, and I had more time to be a father, a role I had to learn anyway since I had no model and didn't do a great job first time round. Carey has forgiven me now, I'm happy to say, and I tried very hard to get it right on my second stint at fatherhood. Life in America was different. The school system was different. The kids were told to respect each other's feelings. Feelings? not a word you'd hear in British schools in the 50s. I'd come a long way from Wolverhampton. The nicest thing about living in Hollywood was that it was no big deal being in showbiz. At my daughter's school, 70% of the parents were in some way connected to the entertainment industry. It's like living in an auto town. That's just what people do. I am what they call in LA a hyphenate. I write, act, sing, perform, direct, produce, and generally show off in all sorts of desperate ways. I've always been a little puzzled as to my true métier, and I once asked my wife what I did best. Well, she said, after a moment's thought, you're very good at dinner. Soon after moving, I got a great role in Casper, a big budget studio movie, which was encouraging, but I'm not really cut out for acting as I get bored easily. So I began to work as a screenwriter. I made quite a good living writing scripts, and for many years Hollywood paid me handsomely, providing me with an enormous income, developing things that never got made. In the end, frustration got the better of me, and I quit. I was tired of being lied to at lunch. I will say, however, that while I'm not a very good writer, I am a good rewriter, and I learned that particular skill in Hollywood. After the earthquake, first thing I did was buy myself a very expensive guitar. It was a handmade Musa and had fallen off the wall at Norm's. No point in dying with a cheap guitar. It's still a beauty. Now we had dinners where people came over and played music. I knew I finally lived in America when I got a dog. I didn't mean to. Lily and I went out to buy a balloon, and we came back holding an exquisite beagle puppy. The minute I put him on my shoulder, there was no way I could put him back in that cage. We drove home with Lily holding this tiny soft thing in her hands. Tanya was reasonably pissed off because she wasn't consulted, and stormed off for an hour because she'd always wanted another German Shepherd. But she soon came back, and of course she fell in love with Bagel the Beagle. Tanya eventually got her Shepherd. Shadow was wonderful, powerful, protective, and very thoughtful. One day, Mike Nichols was leaving our house and looked closely at him. You know, your dog Shadow really reminds me of Julia Roberts. We both looked at him. What? You can see exactly what he is thinking. I taught little Bagel to sing. Being a beagle, he howled like a hound, and one day I picked up my guitar and encouraged him to howl along with me. A few treats later, and I had a singing dog. From then on, he sang at every party. Towards the end of the evening, after dinner, he would make his way next to me, looking at me expectantly. He was ready. I would pick up my guitar and begin to play his song. Bagel, 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 bagel-oo, bagel-oo. He would put his head back and howl. It never failed to kill. He sang to Beatles, he sang to Stones, to Eagles, and of course, to many comedians. That dog sang to the uncrowned heads of Europe. He even sang for Lily at a school concert, the only dog ever allowed in. The great thing about California is you're close to the sea, to the mountains, to the desert, and of course to Las Vegas. Carrie Fisher took us to Vegas for the first time to attend her mother's latest venture. Debbie Reynolds was opening a small hotel just off the strip. We were startled when we got there at 11 in the morning to find her all dolled up and singing Tammy to a small party of Japanese tourists. She had her pianist Rip Taylor with her and was performing her whole cabaret in the tiny lobby. It was very odd. The hotel opening was a disaster. The fire department came to check on safety equipment and the sprinklers went off in every room. Oops. Still, we got to visit the Liberace Museum and gaze at his rhinestone Rolls Royce, and we went to see Siegfried and Roy and their amazing white lions and tigers. A few years later, I met them on Regis, a breakfast TV show in New York, and I was relieved to find that Siegfried was absolutely terrified of their cats and wouldn't go near them. Shortly after, Roy was almost killed by one of his animals. Mercifully, he recovered and came to the Spamalot opening in Vegas. So, there is no escape from show business. There's no exit. You can only get out feet first. Vegas reassured me that as long as I could stand up, I would have somewhere to perform. And what was it but a glorified Blackpool? I thought I would prefer to end my days in the fake glamour of the desert rather than the fake splendour of pantomime in Eastbourne. It's a better class of glitter. Panto was in any case spoiled for me in Wolverhampton when they took us to the Grand Theatre and the female chorus spent the entire matinee in tears. It was puzzling and very odd. On the way back to school, we learned the reason. One of the chorus girls had been murdered. I got to play Las Vegas a few times, once with Kevin Nealon joining Clint Black at a country convention, once with Steve Martin and Tom Hanks as the Two Warm Trio, singing the Galaxy Song for a global warming convention, and once for Penn and Teller's Sin City Spectacular, singing Brightside, chained upside down in a straitjacket, suspended over a vat of boiling oil. I always loved visiting Penn and Teller. Apart from the genius of their magic show, I knew that afterwards you would always have a great discussion for hours in their dressing room about the universe. Another time in Vegas, Steve Martin had an exhibition of his own private art collection at the Bellagio Hotel. His paintings ranged from Picasso to Hopper. Steve is a polymath, which is not a parrot good at algebra. His intellectual range is astonishing. He writes plays and novels and screenplays and funny pieces for The New Yorker and hosts the Oscars and knows everything about art. Of course, he is a banjo player, but then no one is perfect. Actually, he's even perfect at that and has won at least 3 Grammys for his banjo playing. We began to play together at his house in Montecito, and both being a little shy, we encouraged each other. He always wanted me to sing the Galaxy Song, and we did it first at Marty Short's Christmas party, and then publicly. Actually, after Marty Short's Christmas party, everything is easy. I saw even Marty nervously smoking a cigarette outside his own party before he went on. But he is always funny. That's because he tries very hard. We shared a dressing room at the Public Theatre for a charity performance of The Pirates of Penzance, and we both agreed that the best moment in showbiz is when it's over. It's somewhat like sex in that respect. Once, Steve was being honoured by the Kennedy Center in Washington, and there was a gala dinner at the Smithsonian, in a huge art gallery hung entirely with American masters. Carl Reiner, who introduced Steve, said he was so knowledgeable about American masters that he could probably go around the hall and name every single artist on the wall. Well, said Steve modestly, I'm not sure I can. Well, let's see. Homer? Yes, said the curator. Wyeth? Yes. Copley? Yes. Durand? Yes. Stewart? Yes. He went round the walls of the entire room, correctly naming every single artist. Unbelievable. But then he is a magician. We spent some very good times together. He had an amazing house in Montecito where we would go for long weekends. Often Ricky Jay would come for these holiday weekends, and we would be perplexed as he produced constant aces, or using cards as weapons, propelled them across the room into watermelons. Steve was once prevailed upon to do a magic trick at a party at our house, which he did with great aplomb. A few days later, one of Lily's young friends said, "Hey, I saw your magician on TV." I'd hardly been in LA a year when we went scurrying back to London to make a movie. Terry Jones was filming Wind in the Willows and asked me to play Ratty, a big step up from Second Field Mouse, where I started my career. I even got to sing Messing About on the River, an English hit from the 60s. Terry had written the script and was directing, and best of all, he was playing Toad, a role he was born to play. The hilarious, multi-talented Steve Coogan played a very sweet mole, and between takes, he taught me to do Michael Caine impersonations. "I don't fucking well believe it." No, Eric. "I don't fucking well believe it." What bystanders thought of Ratty and Mole doing loud Michael Caine impersonations as we passed by, I have no idea. Tanya and I were fortunate to be on Carrie Fisher's guest list, which meant we were invited by Paul Allen, the Microsoft billionaire, on several amazing trips. The first was a pirate-themed party on Cap d'Antibes, where the Louisiana luthier, Danny Ferrington, pulled out handmade guitars and we all jammed Beatles songs for hours. Paul is a very shy man, but stick a guitar in his hands and he's happy. We played together on several occasions. Once he took us all on a cruise down the Middle Passage of Alaska. where at lifeboat drill, Tanya and I were lined up next to Bill Gates. Wow, I thought, this increases our chances of survival. Until, arriving late, along came James Cameron, the director of Titanic. Oh no, I said, not on our boat. He went and found another. You can't be too careful at sea. On another occasion, Paul took us to an unforgettable masked ball in Venice. We floated down the Grand Canal in gondolas at sunset in glittering 18th century costumes. It was like being in a different century, except for the desperate cries from the paparazzi, who of course couldn't recognize anybody because of their masks. Robin, they would yell hopefully. He and I took to calling out fake names to confuse them. Stephen,
Tom,
Betty,
Your Holiness.
Perhaps the most extraordinary Paul Allen trip was a visit to St. Petersburg. We set off overnight from Helsinki on a large cruise ship and steamed into the city the next morning. I had no idea it would be so beautiful. Peppermint and pistachio palaces, bridges, art galleries and canals. It was even more fabulous than Venice. This dream city was created by Peter the Great, who wanted a port for his new fleet, and moved all the nobles out of Moscow to this swamp and made them build palaces and houses. After a 2-year siege by the Nazis in World War II, the city was a ruin, and only communists could have spent what they did to restore it. Even the tapestries had been painstakingly recreated in France at their original 18th century ateliers. Not a ruble had been spared. It was an extraordinary restoration job, and we lucky few enjoyed it. St. Petersburg was indeed mind-blowing. One day we were getting on a ferry to ride to another palace, and this very sweet little old lady boarded the boat. I was already seated, and she very politely came up and asked me if she could sit next to me. Well, all right, I said, but you keep your hands to yourself. Michael Kamen nearly fell overboard laughing. The opening event was a cocktail party in a gilt and glass salon built by the Empress Catherine the Great. Tanya and I were admiring this mirrored salon as guests quietly assembled, when I became aware of Deepak Chopra, the prominent New Age guru, bearing down on me. I recognized him from Dave Stewart's wedding a few months before, when he had married Dave and Anushka Fiz on the beach at Juan Le Pin. We had also attended the opening of Dave's unlikely sex shop, Coco de Mer, on Melrose Avenue in L.A. Dave had a whole new line of expensive vibrators and strange toys, and he had invited Deepak along to say a little prayer and bless the sex shop. As you do. O Lord, please bless these thy unguents and vaginal jellies, that together we may see heaven. Well, of course, Deepak didn't say that, but he did make Tanya and me giggle that day, as he was wearing rhinestone sunglasses and looked uncomfortably like Peter Sellers in the party. So I was well aware of who he was. George had even warned me, watch out for Deepak, he only really loves money. Not the greatest character reference. Now he was bearing down on me, smiling. He had mistaken me for Dr. Watson. Not Sherlock Holmes Dr. Watson, but Francis Cricks. He thought I was James Watson, one of the pair of molecular biologists who had discovered the structure of DNA in 1953 at the Cavendish Laboratory in Cambridge. Oh, Dr. Watson, he gushed directly to me. This is such an honor. I am so thrilled to meet you. You are the reason I became a doctor. I've always been inspired by your work. That's why I started medicine in the first place. This is truly a great moment for me in my life. There was an uncomfortable silence. Tanya was looking at me. I could see the mischief in her eyes as she enjoyed this moment. How was I going to respond? Well, Deepak, I said, for a start, I'm not him. Secondly, he's at least 15 years older than I am. And thirdly, standing right there. Deepak did a double take, turned on his heels, and raced over to continue his gush. So much for cosmic consciousness. Professor Brian Cox and I have always enjoyed teasing Deepak. We call his chatter the quantum of bollocks, for he manages to mix cosmology and bullshit. There are no extra pieces in the universe. Everyone is here because he or she has a place to fill, and every piece must fit itself into the big jigsaw puzzle. So much for physics. Brian is kinder than me, but Deepak's form of quasi-scientific religiosity gets to him too. Tanya and I both loved Jim Watson when we met him, a charming and funny man, and we shared a couple of meals with him on that trip. It was nice to remember how I would pass the Cavendish Laboratory every morning in Cambridge on my way to lunch at the Footlights, or go for a drink at the Eagle, the famous old pub where Watson and Crick first burst in, excitedly saying they had found the meaning of life. We should never forget that DNA backwards is AND. Sorry, Deepak, I'm just not good at this bollocks. I got a great job on a 4D interactive movie called Honey, I Shrunk the Audience, working with Rick Moranis again. Marcia Strassman, the eponymous Honey, got me the job at the last minute, when Raul Julia fell ill. They were making a 20-minute ride of the movie for Disneyland. It was shot on a huge 70mm camera in long takes, as most of the gags were special effects added later. Huge snakes slithered off the screen in 3D. Lifelike rats ran out of the picture, down through the audience and into the seats. Little weed whackers flicked their ankles, so the scream started at the front and proceeded through the auditorium. These gags were very effective, and we went with Lily to Disney World for the opening. They even took us to Paris when it opened there. And of course, for a kid, the whole VIP tour thing is magic. There's no waiting in line, and you can go on a ride again and again. Paradise. A year later, Anheuser-Busch approached me with an offer to write one of these 4D things. They wanted a pirate film for their Busch Gardens theme park in Williamsburg, Virginia. I was intrigued by the technology, so I wrote one. In mine, when seagulls flew overhead, water would drop like bird poop on the audience. I wrote the lead for Leslie Nielsen, and he said he would do it only if I would be in it too. What, you mean filming in the West Indies on a pirate ship with Leslie Nielsen? Well, all right then. So off we went to Puerto Rico, eventually ending up filming on a boat in Caneel Bay off St. John, where I had stayed so happily with George and Liv. At the end of each day's filming, I would dive overboard and swim back to my hotel. I loved every second with Leslie. He was extremely funny. He would play with his own fame and had found a clever way of coming to terms with it. He had a fart machine. He kept it hidden in his hand. He used it to perfection on a crowded elevator in our tourist hotel. People would enter the elevator and suddenly notice that there was Leslie Nielsen, deep in thought, staring into the middle distance. You would see them recognize him and nudge each other. He would gaze placidly ahead, completely unconcerned, not noticing. They would be trying to make up their minds to say something, but his benign concentration held them back. The doors would close. A moment of silence, and then suddenly there would be a loud fart. Louder than socially polite. Impossible to ignore. But who was it? Leslie would continue to stare straight ahead. His face would not move a muscle. There would be another loud fart. The passengers would begin to look uncomfortable. Was that Leslie Nielsen farting? Now it was awkward. They could hardly burst into, "Aren't you Leslie Nielsen? We loved Airplane. Can I have an autograph?" While he clearly had this epic bowel problem. Another couple of floors of silent descent, and there would be another extremely loud fart. This time, there was no mistaking the source. Leslie would give nothing away. Not a glimmer, not a twinkle. The tourist eyes would meet. They would clearly just have to pretend it wasn't happening. They would give this poor farting star the anonymity his unfortunate entrails deserved. Mercilessly, as the ground floor approached, Leslie increased the tempo. He would play a whole range of farts. Little ones, big ones, short ones, long ones, melodic ones, Handelian ones, starbursts, frog farts. His repertoire was lengthy and relentless. His face a study of intense concentration as this terrible barrage unfurled. Deeply embarrassed for him, the other passengers in the elevator looked studiously at the floor, avoiding each other's eyes and this terrible secret. Finally, the doors opened and the passengers burst out, leaving Leslie saying nothing, revealing nothing. It was the most brilliant controlled display of deadpan acting I ever saw. Another time, Jack Black asked me to sing at Festival Supreme on Santa Monica Pier, a whole-day concert he was organising for comedians who played instruments. My pal Jeff Davis did the set with me, with the assistance of my hilarious assistant Alana Gospodnetich. I had a gag I wanted to try. To introduce us, Jack Black came on and gave me the biggest showbiz intro ever. You know him from this, you know him from that, one of the original Monties. Will you all please welcome Eric Idle? Thunderous applause, and on came Billy Idol. The crowd did a double take. What? And then laughed themselves silly. Billy played up the moment perfectly, strutting round the stage, pouting, pumping his fist, singing, "Oh, I'm a lumberjack." After a few minutes, I came on looking daggers at Billy. "What the hell are you doing?" "I'm doing the show. It says Eric Idle." "No, it doesn't. It says Billy Idle. Not on the poster." "Yeah, on the poster." We argued, we pushed, we shoved, we fought, until Jeff brought out the poster and showed it. "Oh, all right then." Reluctantly, he left the stage to an enormous ovation. We continued our set without him, but he came on at the end and sang Brightside with us. It was one of my favourite gags ever, a visual pun. Billy was such a pro, he came to my house 3 times to rehearse the bit. I eventually repurposed almost everything I ever wrote for Hollywood. The Road to Mars became a novel, The Rutland Isles became a CD, and The Remains of the Piano turned into a concert film of a radio play called What About Dick, which we filmed with the incredible cast of Eddie Izzard, Billy Connolly, Tim Curry, Tracy Ullman, Russell Brand, Jane Leaves, Jim Piddock, Sophie Winkleman, and me. Live before a howling audience for 3 nights at a sold-out Orpheum Theatre in L.A. As Dick Vosburgh, my early mentor, would always say as he filed away rejected gags, "Nothing's wasted." But no matter how comfortable and at home I felt, always there would be the inevitable question, "When are you Python guys getting back together again?" Chapter 23. Python Reunion? In the States, I found that Monty Python was really popular. Everyone knew the Holy Grail. It seemed to be a college rite of passage. Now I helped Seventh Level turn it into a CD-ROM game. They'd been very successful adapting our TV series into Monty Python's Complete Waste of Time, an interactive CD. And now I got to rethink Grail. I loved this new high-tech world. I'd sniffed contemptuously at Timothy Leary in the 80s when he said one day everyone would have a laptop computer. "Why would I want that?" I said, in my snobbish ignorance. "I have a pencil." Now, not only did I have a computer, but I visited Microsoft in Redmond and ESPN and several other companies looking for a home for a Python website. In the end, Seventh Level generously offered to bankroll it. And in July 1996, I founded PythonLine on the newly burgeoning internet, where even spam was named after one of our skits. Running PythonLine was a quotidian task that eventually became Promethean. My ambition had been to create an amusing site to which the Pythons could contribute, and where I could vent my occasional spleen and unfold my propensity for satire. But as the Python contribution soon dried up, and I was left to deal with it solo, the task became increasingly frustrating. Each day, there would be an ever-growing mountain of Python questions. And when I attempted to answer them, the fans would argue with me. "You're not Eric Idle," they would say. "Yes, I am," I would reply. "No, you're not," they would insist. "Then fuck off," I would add. "Oh, you are him." It was an early form of Twitter, how to drive yourself crackers. I found I'd given myself a highly unpaid job, a monster that daily demanded new food. But the popularity of PythonLine made me think that Python was not dead yet, and I came up with an idea for a final Python movie called The Last Crusade, where a bunch of grumpy old knights, loosely based on ourselves, are rounded up reluctantly to go off on a crusade, taking King Arthur's ashes to Jerusalem. They didn't want to do it. "Oh, I can't, I'm too old. The thing is, my mother's coming. This is my year off to read a book." Promised beautiful women and cash, they are lured to Venice, where they are screwed by the Italians. Everyone seemed to like the idea of playing older versions of their younger characters. And I went for lunch and a walk on the beach in Santa Barbara with John Cleese, who sounded quite positive about the notion. And so we arranged for a Python conference at Cliveden, a neoclassical manor on the River Thames in England. Once the Astors' old family home, in 1963 it had been the setting for the Profumo scandal, involving sex, call girls, government ministers, and Russian spies. This helped bring about the collapse of the Tory government. The meeting began rather disastrously when John announced at the outset that he was not interested in making another Python movie. Terry Gilliam, who had just flown overnight from California, where he was prepping a film with Johnny Depp, asked rather acidly if he couldn't have said that before he flew all the way from L.A. John then said he was very tired and went off for a nap. So the rest of us began working on the idea anyway. It was just like the old days of Do Not Adjust Your Set, and we were going quite well when John returned and said he wanted to have a business meeting instead. We had a hilarious dinner, and afterwards the four of us, minus John, had an uproarious game of snooker on the very same billiard table where Christine Keeler had contributed to the Tories' downfall. She hadn't been playing snooker, but the balls were definitely conservative. Next morning, we discussed doing a live show, and as we had all been getting along very well, we decided to accept an invitation to attend the Aspen Comedy Festival. A few months later, in April 1998, we assembled in the thin Colorado air and filmed a Q&A session in front of an invited audience at the Wheeler Auditorium for an HBO special. On John's recommendation, I went to see Eddie Izzard perform and loved him so much that I went back the next night. He was truly funny and unique, and I asked him as a gag to come on stage with us at the beginning of our show. When Robert Klein introduced the Pythons to a cheering audience, Eddie came on as well and took one of the chairs. "How did you all get together?" was Robert Klein's first question. "Well," piped up Eddie, "we were all in the RAF, and we first met in a railway carriage in 1943 at..." But we interrupted him. "Fuck off, Izzard," we said, and threw him off the stage. He went off reluctantly through the middle of the audience, shouting bits of old Python sketches. We had one other gag set up. We brought Graham's ashes out on stage with us in an urn and placed them reverently on a low table with a picture of Graham. We answered a few mild questions, and John was in the middle of a long reply when Terry Gilliam crossed his legs and accidentally knocked the urn off the table, scattering ashes all over the stage. The audience laughed in total shock. We got up and did our best to clean up the mess, shoveling the ashes under the carpet, sipping them into a tiny dustpan, and even bringing on a vacuum cleaner. The laugh went on for 4 minutes and grew even bigger as they realized they had been duped. It was certainly the longest laugh we ever got. And, of course, we finished the show singing Always Look on the Bright Side of Life. The joyous response of the audience seeing us together inspired some of the group to suggest we do a reunion show. And at a business meeting the next morning, this proposal became more concrete. Mike and Terry were for it. John seemed keen, and even Terry Gilliam didn't seem to mind, although he was mainly there to hang out with Hunter S. Thompson, whose Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas he had just filmed. It seemed the Pythons were really keen on doing some kind of a stage show, and I was designated to explore the options. Believing them to be serious, I set off to find the finance. I came back with a solid offer of $10 million from Alan Tivoli, who had been our promoter for Monty Python Live at City Center. Python was to play 6 nights in Las Vegas, culminating in a live TV performance on New Year's Eve. Not a bad idea, and a very decent offer. We were talking dates, venues, and deals. There was a long Python conference call while I was on holiday in Venice. Everyone was in. Then, a month or two later, when I returned to L.A., Michael suddenly reneged. He had said yes, of course, but what he had meant, apparently, was no. He had always had anxieties about doing a live show, though he had not shared these anxieties, and he had, apparently, been very reluctant all along. Of course, it would have been nicer if he had said so earlier. I had spent a lot of time taking meetings and dealing with business people, and now that the offer was concrete, he pulled out. But life is too short to fight with friends, and I find at my age I can barely remember to hold a grudge, So although I confess I was a little pissed with Mike for wasting my time, of course I forgave him. It's impossible to dislike him for long. He is, after all, a national treasure. Although, in his case, perhaps a bit of a hidden treasure. The fallout from Aspen liberated me. Finally, with Python definitely not going on the road, I was now free to play my own songs. I'd been working constantly on music with John Dupre, and we performed a concert at LA's J. Paul Getty Center in 1999 with backup singers and a band, which became a record. Eric Idle sings Monty Python. The following year, this turned into a full-blown, two-month, 20-city tour of the US called Eric Idle Exploits Monty Python. On the road with John Dupre and 21 other people, what was I thinking? Certainly not money. William Morris made more than I did, but in hindsight, this was a smart move. I enjoyed playing to live audiences across America. It was a nice change from developing movies that never got made. I love making people laugh, and I really like singing my songs. Wherever we went, the audiences sang along to Brightside. At Carnegie Hall, I stood on stage in full drag as Dolly Taylor, singing Sit on My Face. Follow that, Brahms, I said, as I looked at his portrait in my dressing room. In the 1997 James Brooks movie, As Good As It Gets, Jack Nicholson sang Always Look on the Bright Side of Life to a dog. Thanks for ruining our film, Eric, he said to me. Thanks for ruining my song, Jack, I said back. We'd met Jack through our friend Angelica Houston and hung out quite a bit with him while Stanley Kubrick was busy driving him and Shelley Duvall mad filming The Shining in London. See Rule 1 for actors. Hans Zimmer, who scored Jim Brooks's movie, asked Art Garfunkel to sing Brightside over the closing credits, and Artie was kind enough to come on stage and sing it for me both nights at Carnegie Hall. A year later, Monty Python was inducted into the Hollywood Bowl Hall of Fame, and John Dupre and I went along with our touring company to accept the trophy. There were wonderful nostalgic clips of us at the Bowl 20 years earlier, and then Robin Williams came on like a blast from a blowgun and torched the audience with a high-octane tribute. Originally, Terry Gilliam was going to join me on stage to accept the award, and then we were going to sing Sit on My Face. But the Bowl nixed that naughty song, saying it was inappropriate for a gala, and so, sadly, Terry Gilliam pulled out. He has very high moral standards when it comes to low moral songs, so that moment of particular public tastelessness would have to wait. Meanwhile, I took the trophy from Robin and said, "It's wonderful to be back at the Bollywood Hole after all these years. I'm proud to be here on behalf of Monty Python to accept this honour. I bring messages and thanks from the others. Terry Gilliam, sadly, can't be with us tonight, as they won't let him show his ass," which has been very favourably compared with Spielberg's ass. "Graham Chapman can't be with us tonight, as sadly, he is still dead. And John Cleese is finishing a movie. He has to get it back to Blockbuster by tomorrow. So that just leaves me here tonight, and so I'd like to thank me, without whom I too wouldn't be here this evening. I'd like to thank everyone at the Bowl for honouring us in this way. I'd like to thank Robin for friendship above and beyond the call of comedy. But above all, I'd like to thank America, and you Americans, for accepting Monty Python's essentially British silliness so warmly, so wholeheartedly, and so surprisingly. Because, you see, I never wanted to do this for a living. I always wanted to be a lumberjack." And on marched a chorus of Mounties to sing The Inevitable, with John Malchieri and the Hollywood Bowl Orchestra. Of course, as we exited, we naughtily sang Sit on My Face. After Monty Python, they honoured Stevie Wonder, introduced with a spot-on impersonation by Smokey Robinson. At the end, there was an incredible curtain call, where I appeared holding hands with Stevie Wonder and Smokey Robinson. "I can die now," I thought, as the crowd went wild, and two of my heroes held my hands, and we bowed on stage at the Hollywood Bowl. Little did I know I would return within a year for a less happy occasion. Chapter 24, George. The new millennium began terribly, with a horrible attack on George. Tanya and I were in Montecito, staying with Steve Martin, when we heard the news that a crazed intruder, off his meds, had broken into Friar Park and fought with George and Olivia until she smashed him across the head with a Tiffany lamp. Some people said, oh, it was just a burglary that went wrong. Some burglary. Some wrong. The reality was horrendous. George and Olivia had fought desperately for their lives for 15 minutes against a man armed with a kitchen knife. George had been stabbed multiple times. When the police arrived, he was at death's door. Now, mercifully, he was out of the emergency room. I called him. "Would you like me to come over?" I asked. "Where are you?" he said. Tanya and I caught the next plane. We were relieved to find them alive. We kept thinking that we could so easily have been flying for their funeral. But mercifully they were home, though bruised, wounded, and shocked. George had 7 stab wounds, which he displayed rolling up his shirt. Some wounds were exit wounds where the blade had simply gone right through him. One stab had punctured and collapsed his lung, leaving him dangerously short of breath, his lung filling up with blood, and George lying on the floor, chanting. "I thought I was dead, Eric," he said. Carried out to the ambulance on a stretcher, covered in blood and quite possibly dying, he said to his 2 new housekeepers, who had just started working for him and whom he had not yet met, "So, what do you think of the job so far?" The first I knew he was going to survive those dreadful early hours was the unmistakably George quote displayed on the BBC website. When the police asked him about the intent of the intruder, he had said, "Well, he wasn't auditioning for the Travelling Wilburys." "Why doesn't this kind of thing happen to the Rolling Stones?" he'd asked me wryly on the phone. It was the ultimate nightmare, an armed intruder in your home at 3:30 in the morning, breaking windows and screaming loudly at you to come down. "I wrestled hand to hand with the face of evil for 15 minutes, said George. 15 minutes is an awfully long time to struggle for your life against a man with a 7-inch kitchen knife while receiving multiple stab wounds. He came racing up the stairs, screaming dementedly, George told me. Having called the police, Olivia ran out with a poker to find her husband on the ground and a man attempting to kill him. She bashed the intruder on the head 15 times with the poker, but amazingly he was able to get up and turn on her. He knocked her over, and she lost the poker and retreated to their bedroom, where he followed her. Although stabbed by then, George was able to get up and go to her aid. At which point Olivia picked up a huge Tiffany lamp and began to bash the man about the head. "It was like a movie," she said. "He wouldn't stop. There was blood everywhere. I kept yelling at him to stop, but he'd just get up again." He grabbed the cord of the lamp and came at her with it. "I thought he was going to strangle me," she said. She knew there was another heavier poker by the fireplace and ran downstairs. He, meanwhile, picked up the lamp and began to beat George with it. "I'd had it by then," said George. "I just tried to put my feet up to stop him. But he took several blows to the head." Then Olivia heard the man coming after her. She felt she could outrun him, but to her relief, she heard him suddenly collapse. All his head wounds had finally caught up with him. Later, to his great joy, George learned she had managed to stab him in the butt. He was to have 22 stitches in his head, a measure of the success of Olivia. But right now, there were 3 totally exhausted combatants. The battle was over. George was lying upstairs, desperately wounded, his lungs filling with blood, chanting Hare Krishna. The intruder was collapsed on their balcony, and Olivia was sprawled at the foot of the stairs as the police entered. It was a scene from a horror movie. Blood was everywhere. Danny, their 21-year-old son, was faced with this dreadful scene. He kept his father conscious during the long wait until the ambulance came. He can always be proud of this, but no son should have to face what he did. By the time Tanya and I arrived at Friar Park, George and Liv were patched up, but angry, like all victims of violent crime, and in need of good friendship. Nobody had more good friends all round the world, and flowers and faxes poured in. We played guitars and sang. George was very shaken. I'd never seen him like this. He needed constant hugs. We were present for a puja, where a Vedic priest performed a short ceremony to thank Shiva for their survival, and to clear the lurking presence of evil from their home. We went upstairs and walked around the various sites